All right, well, we get to start the summer preaching series today. Really excited about this. Just diving into some more practical theology, so to speak. How does theology connect to our daily home life? So we're taking a break from Revelation. Revelation 12 does not suddenly dive into home stewardship. So during the summer, we're taking a break. It'd be 9 weeks of looking at issues related to home stewardship. So gospel-centered home stewardship is the series title. The goal being to recognize not just Jesus saves us, but how does that apply to the way that we manage three things in particular: money, marriage, and parenting. There's probably some other M word we could use for parenting to make it alliterate, but didn't take the time to think of that. So sorry, money, marriage, and parenting, MMP. But we're going to do 3 weeks on money, 3 weeks on marriage, 3 weeks on parenting. And the general shape of this series, hopefully, will be first week, kind of a theological overview. Following 2 weeks, more practical and more practical. And then another theology overview, then practical, like that. So what I want to do first is look at Psalm 127 really quick, just as a reminder of why we're doing this series. So Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. And that's true even for those who have been at church and who claim they're building the house biblically, but aren't actually doing it biblically. So we want to make sure that we're reevaluating ourselves. Even if we've been supposedly building the house based on the Bible for 2-3 decades, continually reevaluating and saying, what does it look like to live out the gospel in my home life, day after day, year after year, especially with regard to these three issues. So as we do this, one key message that we're going to be repeating throughout this, and hopefully it'll become so repetitive that you remember it forever: faithful homes live for Godward goals by gospel grace. If there's any theme message for these 9 weeks as a whole, that's it. So you'll see this statement a lot. Maybe even every single week, maybe multiple times a week. But faithful homes live for Godward goals by gospel grace. If you want to know, what do I need to do to have a faithful home? Live for Godward goals by gospel grace. Not just live for Godward goals by your own strength and power, because you'll fail. Not just live by gospel grace with no goals, because otherwise you're not actually following Jesus. You're just happy that he saved you. Live for Godward goals by gospel grace. As we do this, some quick book recommendations. This is a very logistical intro, but but this is intentional because I wanted to set up the context for this series for you. First of all, Money, Possessions, and Eternity, a book by Randy Alcorn. It is probably 25 or 30 years old now. It's really good. So it is 350 pages, I think. Some of your hearts just fluttered several times. So part two, for those who don't want to read MPE, The Treasure Principle. This would be Money, Possessions, and Eternity, the greatly abridged version. It's the same stuff, just much shorter. The Treasure Principle is one of those little books that's 80 pages or something, and small pages that you can read in 2 hours. So those two are highly excellent books on saying, what does it look like to view my money, my finances, in light of eternity, in light of how God would have us to live? So Money, Possessions, and Eternity, Treasure Principle. Secondly, when we get to the marriage series, there is a book appropriately called Marriage by Paul David Tripp. This one used to be called What Did You Expect? It has been repackaged and I think an extra chapter or two added into a book called Marriage. It's really great. I've used it before in counseling scenarios. Kristen and I have worked through it during the course of that same scenario. Both, it's very helpful, very gospel-oriented in thinking through key principles of what does it look like to live my marriage in light of the gospel. Thirdly, when it comes to parenting, can you guess the name of the book? Parenting. Also by Paul David Tripp. So he's apparently just naming his books with the category title now. He's like, you know what? We're not going with clever titles anymore. Just call it what it is. So parenting is also excellent. Parenting, if you want to feel comfortable in the way you're currently parenting, don't read it. If instead you want to parent in a way that is gospel-oriented, tracking your kids toward Jesus with a self-critical and child-helpful mentality, read it and devour it. It is a very good book. He will challenge you. He will call you to watch your own heart as well as those of your children. There are other good parenting books available. This is just, if we're putting one recommendation, I feel like this is one of the top ones on the list.
Those are free audiobooks through the library.
These are all free audiobooks on Hoopla, David has confirmed. He is currently listening to them and not to me, even though he just told me that. You can tell David's the one who actually listens to books on Hoopla. I'm the one who barely remembers what Hoopla means. So I have these books on Kindle. David has them on Hoopla. They are free on Hoopla. Kindle is not free. You actually have to pay Amazon stuff for it. So the great thing is you pay him money, you don't actually get anything. You just get digital bits and the right to use them for a while, but that's me. So money, possessions, and eternity. Or if you don't like reading that much, Treasure Principle. Or read them both just because it's good, and Treasure Principle is a good, like, Cliff Notes summary. Marriage, parenting. If you get all of those and read through all of those, you won't have to come this summer, except you should. You still should, because it's different being here among the people of God and worshiping together and seeking him together. So with that, I want to pray before diving into this week's sermon. It's an interesting thing that we're preaching is kind of a regular recognition that you're both ready and not ready at all at the exact same time, which is why it's a great thing the Holy Spirit is doing the real work. And the same is true this week. So let's pray. God, thank you that you have saved us. Thank you that the gospel does apply to all areas of life and even home life. And that applies to money and marriage and parenting as much as to anything. And so I pray that as we kick off this series, as we look at the theology of money this morning, Spirit, that you would be active to speak, that you would be active to apply all this in our hearts, that you would be active to change us more and more into the image of Jesus, that these would not just be words that we say, that they would not just be trite prayers that sound Christianese, but that this really would be the cry of our hearts, that we would long to approach and use our money in a way that honors you. Pray that you would use the words that I say to convey truth, and that you would shut me up if I shouldn't say something, or that you would cause people to forget what I've said if it's stupid, because what we really need is your truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Cultural blind spots, what are they? There are things maybe for a temporary time period, maybe for a generation, maybe for certain categories of society that we just don't kind of see, even though they're part of the warp and woof of culture, so to speak. They're part of everything we do, but we don't always notice them. Generationally, perhaps culturally, currently, if you ask ChatGPT, what are some blind spots in the United States culture currently? One of the first things it mentions is consumerism. It's like, hey, you're really smart. Good job, ChatGPT. In North America, money is a functional god. You don't believe me, but I'm going to say it again. In North America, money is a functional god. And we grow up from the time that we're born to the time that we die in the midst of a society that praises, loves, pursues, honors, glorifies, it listens to advice from money and those who have it. The people who have the money are thereby declared smart. People who have the money are thereby declared successful. It doesn't matter how they got it. Doesn't matter who they knocked down along the way. Doesn't matter whether they inherited it rather than building it. Doesn't matter whether they built it with help of others who they now ignore. Doesn't matter. They have money now, therefore they are successful. That means they're smart. That means I should definitely listen to them. That means they definitely should lead us in any number of ways. Whether that's local society or politics or the PTA or churches. which unfortunately have at times been increasingly run as businesses by businessmen, which produces a horrible scenario for church pastoral hiring, by the way. In the past several years when I was looking at church jobs and such, you find church resumes or church job listings and you're sending a resume. It's a dumb situation anyway, because church is ministry, not just merit-based whatever. But anyway, and what you get is a lot of people sitting around, in some cases, none of them who are actually pastors, depending on the size of the church, and they're evaluating, does this person merit our consideration? And they're thinking through like a business context and how do we run this? And the whole relationship's terrible. Like, have a couple interviews, pretend like you know the person now and say yes or no and hope for the best. The more that business has infected the church, it's become a problem. Church pastors are not CEOs. Church leadership is not a board of directors. We are people seeking to minister together the gospel. Sorry, that's a sidebar. but that's how much money has infected us that we don't even see it as it infiltrates the church and the ways that we do things. Like, it's, you can sit here and step back from it and go, whoa, it's there. Wow. We don't realize it. There's an illustration that's been mentioned many times. So as I say this, some of you can go, oh yeah, I know what you're about to say. But who is wealthy? It turns out that if you ask any demographic, the truly wealthy is probably the next rung up. You ask those who make $30,000 a year, they're wealthy when they're at 50. You ask the 50,000, it's 70. You ask 70, it's 100. You ask 100, oh, it's 250. You ask the 250s, it's 1 million. You ask the millionaires, no, it's at least 10 million. We've done surveys about this. We've done cultural studies about this. It's a consistent pattern. I am not wealthy. Those guys are. The ones above me, they're the wealthy ones. Now, if the ones above everyone are the wealthy ones, who's actually wealthy? Well, ask someone overseas, and literally all of us are. So which ones are they? I've seen people literally on the internet, on Reddit, complaining about, man, I wish I could make as much money as you Americans do for the same exact job. Because in different cultures, there's different pay grades. And in different cultures, there's different social provisions and taxes and everything, all like very complex scenarios, but whatever. Some people are making less money but getting better social provisions. Some people are making more money with less social provisions, all that kind of stuff. Even so, if you ask most people around the world, someone making $30,000 a year is really, really rich. So who's really wealthy? Well, we don't know. But it seems that in many cases, this image would actually typify the American spirit. Mark, if you can grab, there it is, yeah. Wealth. All I ask is for a chance to prove that money can't buy happiness. This is from a website that has been one of my cherished favorites since college. It is despair.com, who makes the Demotivators posters. Their tagline is, motivational posters don't work, but our posters don't work better. It is beautiful, it's cynical, it's hilarious. I encourage you all to go read through their posters sometime, and then you'll be like, now I understand why Eric's such a moron. He likes this stuff. But in many cases, their posters are unfortunately incisive, clear, insightful. And this is one of them. Because though we've heard the richest at times say, money doesn't buy happiness. Though we've seen Solomon say it in Ecclesiastes, though we've heard it throughout our lives from various people at various levels of wealth, we're still like, you know, I'd like a chance to test that one though, huh? Can I have the wealth and see if I'll be happy instead? I have seen it many times on Reddit. I've had a coworker tell me as well, it is not possible to live with a salary that is less than six figures. So for any of you who are not making six figures currently, you're actually not living, it turns out. You are dead, or something, or you have no life. I don't know which or the other, but it's something like that, because people on Reddit are authoritative. They know what they're talking about for sure. But the problem is, that is increasingly the thought in our culture. Reddit is just one website after all. It is only a sub-segment, but it is a real segment, and it's growing, and it was actually striking to have an actual person with a face, coworker, tell me the same thing one time recently. So now we can't live with less than six figures, Sure, some of the cost of living stuff has increased, rent is higher than it used to be, et cetera. Unfortunately, I would respond to anyone who says that, you don't know how to budget. And here's our problem culturally. Money is the god that enables my consumerism. Money is the god that enables my materialism. And as society continues to increase our materialism, and as we, Christians indeed, are pulled into the same thing, yeah, now I need more money in order to live, in order to do anything. Because the exorbitant amount of eating out that we now do, which generations past didn't do, we should be able to do that, guaranteed, definitely, for sure, please. We might not sign up for social welfare health programs, but we'll sure sign up for social eating out programs. Who's with me? Increase my taxes and I get to eat out 3 times a week? We'd go for that. I think a politician might actually succeed running on something like that. Yeah, give me eating out all the time, please. These things that previous generations did not do. Previous generations knew how to do this thing. What they do is they go to the grocery store and they get food. Food, it's various things that you eat and ingredients. There's this thing you call making something from scratch. It's a weird term. What it means is you take different ingredients in different amounts and you mix them together. It's this thing that the people at the restaurants you go to do. They mix stuff together and then they put it on a plate for you. Previous generations knew how to do this themselves. Current generation is increasingly forgetting how to do so, or increasingly unable to do so due to life commitments, job commitments, etc. But we have to see, as I'm being totally sarcastic and joking around, that all of this is driving from somewhere. And all of this is built into our culture at this point. We must have, we must do, we must get, we must obtain, we must be allowed to have. We need to have 15 phones on 13 cellular plans. We need to have all the streaming services in the world because God knows we can't miss out on the entertainment. If someone says, haven't you seen that show? And we say, oh, no. Oh, shoot, I'm a fool and I'm missing out. I need to see this thing too because they think it's cool. I must pay for this. So we can spend hundreds of dollars literally on streaming services if we would desire, including the cable subscription that you probably shouldn't have anymore because streaming is there, but you keep it just in case. Including internet that is definitely necessary to have a gigabit both directions because you need to be able to stream YouTube for a little bit. It's not necessary. I'm an IT guy. You don't need that much, I promise. We've got subscriptions for people to deliver food to our homes. And we feel like we should cook at home, so now we can pay someone to deliver us food with a recipe attached so that it'll tell us how to cook it up. We have subscriptions for people to give us new clothes because we wouldn't want to have to shop for ourselves. We might have to actually think through what our size is. We got subscriptions for people to deliver food, to go pick up food for us, to go to the restaurant and get the food because I don't want to have to see the people that make the food. Just bring it to my doorstep, please, so I cannot tip you enough. Everything's turning into subscription society. Everything's turning into more money for more stuff. And if we buy into that, and if we need a new car every 3 months with a new car payment every 3 months, then yes, you can't live on less than 6 figures. But can we let that claim be an indictment of our society today? Let that be a reason for us to check our own hearts, and are we actually in the world but not of it? Are we actually living in North America but being aware of a major god that North America pushes us toward? In case anyone's wondering, in Greenville, the average salary is $55,000 to $75,000, and easily the average salary is like $45,000 to $65,000 or $70,000. So there's a lot of people living on less than 6 figures. As it turns out, Reddit really isn't correct, even though that's becoming more the feeling for people. This is really no surprise, though, that we would think this way. Ecclesiastes 4, starting in verse 4. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a hand full of quietness than 2 hands full of toil and striving after the wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Ecclesiastes 6, verse 7, all the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The wisest man who ever lived, who had all the wealth in the world, pursued it all and tested it out, tells us many times, these are three of them, that if you make wealth your pursuit, there will be no end of that. If you make what you think to be riches your pursuit, as goods increase, they increase who consume them. How many tales have we heard of people who win the lottery and then they're bankrupt almost immediately afterwards? How many tales have we heard of people who get a raise and the next year say they're still living paycheck to paycheck? People who get a major raise, a huge promotion, and they're still living paycheck to paycheck. We need a different approach to money than North America has. People are massively in debt to credit cards, massively in debt to school debt, massively in debt to car debt, massively in debt to the previous shopping binge they did for their new clothes for the month. New clothes every year, new video games every year, new toys every year, new everything. And we pretend like the only people who are materialists are the kids at Christmas. We need to make sure we're approaching money in a way that Jesus would. Jesus talked about money more than anything, as it turns out. Statistically speaking, in the Bible, he talked about hell, he talked about salvation, he talked about the kingdom of God, and he talked about money more than all of that, more frequently. That should send us a message. That should call us to stay awake to reality of, you know what? The culture's approach to money is dangerous. It was back then, it is now. There's a reason that Jesus said it so often. And his approach to money was probably summarized best in Matthew 6, 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Now, either you call Jesus a liar, or you cannot serve both God and money. Not you might not be able to, not maybe you can't, not all I ask is a chance to prove that someone can't serve both God and money. No, you cannot serve both God and money. The two are diametrically opposite pursuits. There's no way to say, I'm serving God, and yeah, money, money, money. It's like one is this direction, and the other is that direction. You cannot serve both God and money, says Jesus. I think we see this really easily when we look around in our society. We have a regular rhythm, it seems, of impersonal layoffs that are in the news as the rich get richer suddenly, but they still need to lay off a bunch of people whose lives are now thrown into chaos and who flood the market with more job searches. We need to cut off the bottom 5% just because we said so, because there's someone who said that was a smart thing to do, so we're going to get rid of them. We need to cut off others. We're going to claim they were low performers, except it turns out they weren't, but they just made a lot of money. And now we need better margins. Because when you invest money in a thing, you've got to get money back out, say the big firms. And so, well, you're not enough money. You can go away for now. Or we look at the national budget, which is so wonderful right now. Ignoring all of the everything in terms of the political back and forths, I did some study a couple months ago. And essentially, unless we get charged a lot more taxes, the budget's not even going to balance, let alone ever catch up on the debt. But we have people saying two things at the same time that don't work, and this is the point. One, I want to be charged less taxes. Two, I want the national budget to balance. It's impossible for both of those to be true unless we completely gut the entirety of the budget. If you look at it point by point, it's pretty crazy. Anyway, the reason for that being a point in this is to say we do that on a personal level too. In our personal budgets, we try to have it all and still have something left over even though we took it all, which therefore we have lots of people in tons of debt and all this sort of thing. Our national debt and our personal debt are in relatively similar positions sometimes. So we get to the end of all this, and people love, in sermons like this, making, hey, money isn't evil disclaimers. Meanwhile, we're in debt and limited in what we'll even do for ministry. So I'm not making that disclaimer. Money might be evil in your life. It might be the great God that's stealing away your joy, that's stealing away your ministry potential, that's stealing away your fun with your family, that's stealing away your flexibility to do things in life. Consumerism, materialism, they are preached to you from every corner of this nation. So it might be an evil that you need to watch out for. Let it be only after a careful analysis that we conclude, okay, my approach to money is safe right now and it's not an evil thing. You cannot serve both God and money. So the point today, only Godward contentment brings true riches. Only Godward contentment brings true riches. Contentment that is oriented toward God and his ways brings true riches. We talk about wealth, we talk about having it all and all of this, and yet it doesn't last, and it's only temporary. So if you'll turn to 1 Timothy 6, we're going to spend a fair bit of time there, although relatively briefly at various points. But I want to take some key direction from Paul on this as we respond to what we see Ecclesiastes show, as we respond to what we've seen in the culture around us, as we look for a biblical theology of money and how do we use it. So 1 Timothy 6, starting in verse 6, and I'll deal with the context in just a second, but these verses in particular. But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Jumping down to verse 17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. So as Paul's closing out 1 Timothy, he's urging Timothy to teach and cling to what is true, unlike those who are false teaching and pursuing money, thinking that godliness is a means of gain. That's what he says in the first five verses. Therefore, he says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness, or the promotion of spiritual ideas, people would go around and teach and try to make money off of it, right? Self-help coaches, et cetera, gurus, all these kind of things. Or Christian church preachers who say cool things to make tons of money. But godliness is not a means of gain, a means of wealth. That's not the point. And so Paul turns and says, no, godliness with contentment is great gain. God's values, not societal values and ways of making money by being the best speaker. So several points, they're all listed directly in the notes. You don't have to fill the blanks because I don't want anyone to miss any or to have to feel like you're missing any. Living God's way is true wealth. Verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain, right? Godliness, pursuing God's morals, his way of being, his righteousness, reflecting him with contentment with regard to life and my possessions and my money and everything, that is great gain. By contrast to the false teachers who sought to teach spirituality as a means of gain, no, if you are godly with contentment, you have great gain. So they were going to get godliness for just gain. You instead can have great gain. It's an upgrade. It's a promotion. Right? They're going to get gain, but you're promoted. You get great gain. And all you have to do for that is have godliness with contentment. Living God's way is true wealth. Secondly, material things serve a temporary purpose. Verse 7, we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. We have societal proverbs about this. Right? You can't take it with you. That's 1 Timothy 6, 7. You brought nothing in. You were born naked as a tiny little child that came out of your mother's womb. And you will die not naked because we dress you up before we put you in, we put a big fancy suit on you or whatever else, but you might as well be because you're just going to rot. You're going to rot a little slower than previous generations because of the processed food. Congratulations. But you're going to rot. That's how it works. You're going to live for a while. You're going to have some things, and none of the things that you have right now are going to go with you. When I was younger, when Kristen and I, a year after we were married, we moved to California. The entire time we were in California, we rented. Our first year here, we rented. It wasn't until we got back in South Carolina that we ended up buying a house. Now, the time in California and here then, our first year here, the places that we paid for were a temporary purpose. We did not take our place with us to California. We did not take our California apartment with us back here. They were only a temporary use, and the money that we put towards those, it worked. We got to stay in those places because we paid those property management companies. They let us stay. We were warm and we were cool when we had heat or air conditioning or whatever. We had a place to cook. We had a place to sleep. We recovered from the storms. Everything was the way it was meant to be for that rental period. And then we moved on. Everything that you have in your short existence here is a rental, is a temporary purpose. You're not taking anything from this world, materially speaking, into eternity. And your 30 to 92 to 120, maybe if you live super, super, super old, years here is just a blip on the radar compared to eternity. So we need to realize when the Bible talks about being pilgrims, that applies to our possessions too. Even if we own a home, even if we own our cars outright, anything, it's only a temporary rental for a temporary purpose. You will not take it with you. And that's part of why godliness with contentment is great gain. Because at the start of verse 7, it says for. It means because, right? Because it's temporary. Enough is enough. Verse 8. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. Paul says this elsewhere in Philippians, talking about I've had much, I've had little, I've lived with these things in anything and everything. I've learned the secret of contentment that Jesus provides for me. Right? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The verse that is pulled out of context and plastered on weight gyms everywhere. I can do all things through Jesus who strengthens me. That's not what he's saying. He's not saying you can bench press 1,000 pounds. He's saying you can live with much and with little through Christ who strengthens you. He's saying he's done the same. He's saying any of us can do the same. You can live with much or with little through Jesus. You can live with medium amounts through Jesus too, as it turns out. Everything on the spectrum from much to little. Enough is enough. Like it just really is. Our culture doesn't want us to sign up for enough. When we're satisfied, our culture is sad. Because when we're satisfied, we don't spend on new things constantly. When we're satisfied and content, we actually have extra money sitting around. We're like, hey, I actually have a buffer. I actually have savings. And then we don't have to spend on things with interest because we can just buy them. And the banks don't like that because they like getting interest, or the credit cards even more so. Only 20% interest after all. You know, as long as you pay the minimum payment, you'll eventually get out of it by the time you die. They are required legally to put it that way. But they like it when you can't actually pay for something. Deferred payments are wonderful for the credit companies. They are not wonderful for you. When enough is enough, it's a lot easier to have the buffer and to use it freely for God's purposes. So it's no surprise that Paul says, if we have these, we can be content. But by contrast to those who are content with enough, pursuing wealth is a dangerous snare. Oh, Eric, you're just making it sound bad. No, look at what he says in verse 9 and 10. Those who desire to be rich, how many of us, it's 100%, have grown up in a country that tells you to desire to be rich? Everything we get throughout our schooling, throughout the commercials, throughout the billboards, throughout the marketing, you can't turn anywhere without seeing something encouraging you to desire to be rich, either with literal money or with material possessions, or both, or experiences, live the rich life, et cetera, et cetera. It's everywhere. Those who desire to be rich, as contrast to those who are content with enough, fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. That is the Bible, that is God, his expert opinion on what happens if we desire to be rich as the goal, as the thing we're pursuing. What I want to do is be rich. I've got to build this up. I've got to have this stuff. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be financially independent, retire early by the time I'm 35. I'm not making that up. That's not exaggeration. That's a real group if anyone hasn't heard of FIRE people. Financially independent, retire early. How fast can I save up? How fast can I retire? People who are retiring when they're 35 or 40. I desire to be rich. God's assessment, if you desire to be rich, is you are falling into a temptation, a snare, senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. This is the caution toward contentment. Contentment is good. If you go that way, you're running into a snare, a pit. It's going to drag you down. It's going to pull you away. You're going to do nothing except fall to destruction. This is why when you read in Ecclesiastes, and I've emphasized this before when I've taught through Ecclesiastes, but Solomon in Ecclesiastes, he's like, I tried all this stuff and it was vanity. I tried all this stuff and it was vanity. I tried this. And he says, the best thing is to enjoy the life God's given you with contentment. And our American ambitious minds go, oh, really? That's the best thing? So this is a cynical view. I see how it is. You're saying the best thing is lame. I got it. You think life is lame. No, he's saying literally the best thing you can do is to be content with the good life God's given you. When you do all this other stuff, you're falling into a pit, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. Do you want senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction? Or do you want joy in serving God faithfully and rejoicing in life? The best thing you can do is to be content and to take what he's given you and use it well. When Solomon says that, it's not cynicism, it's reality. But North America doesn't like that. So we say he's a cynic. He's a cynic. He thinks that money is not a good pursuit. The love of money, this one's been misquoted many times. This verse, verse 10, has often been quoted as money is the root of all kinds of evils. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. We should be clear here. But the love of money is something that is preached from every corner of the United States of America. When we see these layoffs in the news, we feel kind of bad about it personally, or if it affects us, we feel really bad, or if it affects our neighbor or our family member, we feel worse. But the reality is, corporations legally required to seek what is in the best interests of the shareholders of said company. Most of the big businesses that are doing layoffs, what they are required to do is to find the best way to return money to those who hold share in the company. Now, if that is a public company and has people literally on the stock market or mutual funds holding shares, or if that is a more privately held company and it's the people who privately hold the company and their shareholding of it, that's what a shareholder is, and they are legally required to do this. So when companies lay off a bunch of people impersonally, they end up being praised for it as long as the bottom line looks good. That is the culture we currently live in with regard to legal requirements for corporations. Now, there are different sorts of corporations that have come up in the past few years, which is really cool. One of them is called a public benefit corporation, where it says, actually, this kind of corporation is legally required / allowed to choose what is best for the shareholders or the employees or the customers, the stakeholders in general, those who hold a stake in what this business does, which is anyone who's impacted by it. Public benefit corporations are in part a response to the greed and manipulation of shareholder-only mentalities. I'm getting really nerdy and businessy right now, so sorry. But you've got to realize, here's the thing. The point of this being, this kind of behavior, the pursue love of money, get the money at all costs, our society praises it. So we can feel bad when our family member gets laid off, but it doesn't matter from the top level because our laws require the company to do that kind of behavior. And when the shareholders get their returns and when money makes money because you invest it and you get more money, those layoffs come from all those investments that are making more money at the end of the day. That structure is built that way. And that doesn't mean don't invest, it's terrible. But it does mean recognize this is how the society is built. And we have to be more careful with how we think through some of these things, lest we get pulled on the same train. And also beware of the claim that might go like this. I don't desire wealth. I just fill in the blank. I just need this other car. I just need this other vacation. I just need this other whatever, whatever. There are lots of people in other cultures currently and in our culture in previous generations and some people in our culture presently who would say, you don't actually need that. I promise. I'm getting just by just fine without it. Part of the lie that Satan would give us in cultural blindness is to read this sort of thing, those who desire to be rich, the love of money, and to immediately say, well, that's not me. It might be you, because our culture's been preaching it to you since the day you were born. So take a look at your heart and say, well, wait, God, am I actually desiring to be rich? Am I actually pursuing wealth? Obviously, we recognize in an exchange-based society where money is part of that structure, we do need money in some sense in order to provide for things. I can't pay for food at the grocery store without some money. It's part of how we exchange work for money, exchange the money for other things that other people worked for. We're not a bartering society anymore. But do I love money? Do I desire to be rich? Why do I work? Do I work to get money? Or do I work to serve faithfully in God's good world? And I get paid fairly for what I'm doing. But the reason I work is to serve Jesus. The reason I work is to build up this world he made. Or do I work just to get more money and then get more money and put the money for money and money for money for money for money? And eventually I have so much money that I don't need God anymore. It's great. Because I've got so much savings and I've got so much insurance that I wouldn't even need him even if something tragic happened to me. That's ultimately part of the lie that our society wants you to believe in the pursuit of money. It's like our modern Tower of Babel. We can get so big and powerful, we don't even need God. I can buy anything I want. I can spend anything I want on anything. Beware. Wealth breeds arrogance. Down to verse 17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty. Haughty is that fancy word meaning prideful, arrogant. Charge them not to be arrogant. Wealth breeds arrogance. Those who have the money think they're better than other people, inevitably, in a society that tells them they are. When the structures that we have say, having money makes you successful. Having money makes you better than that poor schmuck who just didn't try as hard as you. The only way you'd have money is because you built it yourself anyway. No one helped you. That means you're amazing because you've got so much money. He's a dolt because he doesn't have any money. Dolt, it means fool. It's an old word, sorry. It's a cool word, fun one to say. But what do we often say about the poor, the homeless? It's their own fault they got themselves there. What a callous jerk face thing to say. Yeah, sometimes it is, but people still need our sympathy. So people still need our care and our love. And maybe they made poor decisions. Maybe they got sick and couldn't pay their bills because hospitals charge exorbitant amounts and their family decided they hate them or something. Who knows? We don't know their story. But to assume that I have money and you don't and the only difference is because I'm cool and you made bad decisions, that's arrogance. You brought nothing into the world. You'll take nothing from it. And the money you have is a gift from God. And even if you used literally only your own intellect and your own effort, no one does that. But even if you actually did, that's only intellect and effort that you got from God. None of this has truly been created by you, for you, by your own brilliance. But North America says it has. Even those who invest and get massive wealth, Warren Buffett, he's such a brilliant investor, that's why he got it. He's amazing. Maybe he's a smart guy who's done smart investments. Maybe that is genuinely the only reason he's got a ton of money. But even if it is, he got it from God. Even if it is, he got that wisdom to make those smart investments from God. But also, again, part of those smart investments, the underlying current, is mistreating those at the bottom of the ladder so that you get the money at the top. So is that actually cool, or is it just another way of ambition and power reigning supreme? We need to think clearly and Godwardly about these things, because the people who have the money, they might be awesome. There are people who have money who are awesome. There really are. God has put some people in very cool positions. There's people, there's cool stories of people who run businesses that end up making tons of money, and they're using it to fuel really good ministries and all sorts of stuff. So it's not that if you have money, you're evil. No, that's not true. But the lie we're being sold by our culture is if you have money, you're smart, brilliant, expert, better than other people. And that lie infects people who have money to think they are. Therefore, beware, wealth breeds arrogance. Secondly, beware, wealth breeds false hopes. Same verse. Charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches. False hope, the uncertainty of riches. I alluded to it a minute ago. I'll get so much money, I don't need God anymore. But whether you agree or disagree with the way that the U.S. government's handled tariffs and everything recently, we've seen very quickly how fast riches can shift around, even if it's only for a short time period, right? Like, even if you love what Trump has done, the markets have certainly gone, ah! And then back up, and then, ah! And so if you're looking at your stock portfolio recently, it's like this rather than like this. And that's just blunt reality of the way it's been the past couple of months. That's the uncertainty of riches. Or even if you have a massive savings and then you get a huge life-threatening injury or whatever, you're going to spend a lot of money on things you didn't expect to spend on. The uncertainty of riches. Even if you have stuff saved up and suddenly you have a house fire and it's caused in some way your insurance doesn't pay for or something, now you've got to buy a new house somehow. The uncertainty of riches. You've got a cool new job and then you get to be one of the benefits of one of those impersonal layoffs because you're one of the newest people. And you go into a job market where white-collar jobs are really hard to find sometimes. The uncertainty of riches. Don't set your hopes on false things. Money is useful. Money is not God. Money is not your provider. Therefore, trust God, not money. Verse 17. Don't be haughty. Don't set your hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. And riches used for good are an eternal investment. They, the rich, are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, that they may take hold of that which is truly life. Riches used for good are an eternal investment. They're storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, verse 19. And how are they doing that? Not by investments and portfolios and insurances and whatever. No, by doing good, by being rich in good works, by being generous and sharing, ready to share even, eager to share. Where's an opportunity to share? This is the way they're storing up a treasure as a good foundation for the future. So that brings us around to the conclusion summary statement that I then want to flesh out briefly. But this hopefully can be a useful statement for this three-parter on money. Gospel-based contentment fuels eternal investment. We see that here throughout 1 Timothy. We see it throughout Scripture, that a contentment that is grounded and based in the gospel and Godward goals, it's not just that it's a good thing. It literally fuels eternal investment, the kind of eternal investment that would make me ready to share, that would make me eager to be rich in good works, that would make me generous. Those things that Paul says are an investment as a good foundation for the future, those things are fueled by gospel-based contentment. When my goals are shaped by the gospel, when my goals are shaped by God's goals, when my knowledge is that my certainty is in Jesus, not in riches, when my knowledge is that my payment for sin is in Jesus, not in riches, when my knowledge is that everything that I truly long for the most, salvation of friends or relatives, eternity with Jesus, etc., is already bought and paid for by him and can't be bought by money. I can't pay some price to buy salvation. Not for myself or anyone else. So all the money in the world isn't going to get you to eternity. The things that truly matter most are not bought with money. They're bought with blood of Jesus. When I know that that's all true, and when I know that my mission in this earth is a gospel-oriented mission, not a United States money-oriented mission, it frees me up to be able to invest eternally. A gospel-based contentment fuels eternal investment. So the treasure principle the book that's named after it, or Randy Alcorn calls it this, but the principle is where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And that's a quote from Jesus, right, in Matthew 6. Randy Alcorn rephrases it, where your treasure is, there your heart will go, where your heart will follow. Where you invest, the things you pay money into. And you've probably all seen this in life. When you put money towards something, you start caring about that thing more. Whether it's subscription-based or investment-based or whatever, when you put money towards something, you care more about it. Your heart follows your investment. The people that you might compare yourself to, they make more than you, they have more things, they do more stuff, etc. Oftentimes, in this Western world, those people who you might compare yourself and feel like, oh man, we just don't have it, are living for a goal that directly conflicts with your human calling. Because your human calling is not have it all and be your own little king of your own little kingdom. Your human calling is to join in God's good work to help this earth flourish. That's Genesis 1. Join in, help the earth flourish, cultivate the earth. That's your human calling. Then your gospel calling is even more specific. Help rescue people lost in sin so that they can be restored to actually serve properly again. Neither of those is make as much money as possible, right? Like that's a totally secondary thing. And sometimes in God's calling for certain people, he uses making a lot of money as part of that calling toward radical generosity. Other times, in most cases, he calls us all to be faithful with much less than those who have a lot in our culture. At the end of the day, money is a powerful servant, but a horrible God. A powerful servant, but a horrible God, a horrible master, even if you don't want to call it a God, which is why Jesus says you can't serve two masters. You can't serve both God and money. But faithfulness, the return on investment is in eternity. If we are faithful, what is my return on investment? It's eternal. It's lasting forever. So what is money, positively speaking? It's a tool. It is a servant to be used in carrying out my human and Christian callings. Jesus gives that parable of the guy who was going to be fired from his job, and then he kind of shrewdly manipulated accounts to get friends for himself. He's like, oh, what a jerk. And Jesus is like, he was smart. Jesus isn't necessarily saying that what he did was morally right, but at that moment, he's noting the wisdom of what the guy did. And he says, therefore, use earthly wealth, earthly money, to make friends for yourself, to connect things, etc. So Jesus is noting there is a value in money as a tool for Godward purposes. But money taken as my master, it'll just whip you and beat you all your life. You'll never have enough. So one thing I want to encourage you all with as we move to finish here is give yourself a raise. Look at your money. What's the money you currently are given, the money God has currently entrusted you with? And what are the things that you can be content not to have in order to have more buffer? That's not a raise, Eric. That's just accepting less. Yeah, kind of. Except when you're content with less, then it is effectively a raise in terms of having more buffer because you realize, I don't actually need those things. I'm getting fine without them. Cool, I'm good. If you learn to budget well with what God has given you, instead of trying to force your money fit some North American ideal, you'll find you have money because he provides enough. And with food and clothing, with these we will be content, says Paul. So may God help us all to be those who take what he's given, to use it toward generosity, to use it toward good works, to use it for eternal investment with gospel-based contentment. God, thank you that you not only call us, that you not only give us a mission, but you empower us for that mission. That you empower us with your spirit. You empower us with your grace and love. And that you do give us the resources we need for it. And I pray as we are many people, therefore we are all at different places, both in terms of how much money we have and how content we are or aren't with it. I pray that you, Spirit, would be at work in each of us to help us to have a radically Godward perspective with regard to our finances, to help us to be those who truly are radically generous, eager to share, eager to benefit the society around us, eager to use what you've entrusted to us for the good of the world you've put us in. That we would be careful and cautious with cultural wisdom, knowing that some stuff is truly wise and other stuff is fueled by a lie from the devil. That we would weigh the financial advice we get against the gospel and against your goals to see where it aligns and where it doesn't. That we would be Christians who are eager to serve you faithfully with money and eager to recognize where money is just being a lie, where money's trying to be our God or our master. Help us by your power that money would be our servant. And I pray that as we look toward the next couple weeks of looking at how we use our money, that this theology of money, of using it for your glory, of being cautious of the way it can become a god, that this would fuel an eagerness in us to be increasingly faithful with how we use our money for your goals. In Jesus' name, amen.